Mets Musings is presented by FanDuel. FanDuel is the leader in one-day fantasy sports for money with immediate cash payouts, no commitments, and leagues from $1. Sign up at FanDuel.com and use the promo code METSMUSINGS. And by BaseballTalkRadio.com. BaseballTalkRadio.com is the home of over 30 of the finest baseball podcasts, with podcasts covering the U.S., Canada, and even a podcast on Japanese baseball. Fantasy leagues, we got you covered. Even a groundskeeper, we got it right here. If it's baseball, we'll be talking about it at BaseballTalkRadio.com, the home of great baseball talk shows.
Now it's time for some New York Mets baseball talk. Here's Gary Mack bringing you the latest news and analysis from Mets Nation and the world of baseball on another edition of Mets Musings.
And hello and welcome to another edition of Mets Musings. It's an anniversary issue. It's episode number 250. Yeah, 250 episodes of Mets Musings, and you're here with me, and I'm glad to have you with me, and it's been a joy doing all 249 so far up to this date. Not such a joy for the Mets this past weekend, as they were swept by the Atlanta Braves, and just a pitiful display, no hitting. Pitching was not awful, but wasn't dominating what we're used to seeing. And they went down to the Atlanta Braves. The Braves was hitting. They had their hitting shoes on. And they're a bad team, but they have some good hitters and some good players on that team. And, wow, the Mets ran into that buzzsaw over the weekend. And they needed the day off on Monday, got a well-deserved day off to recoup, to refocus, and they came back strong on Tuesday, but boy, was that a freaky game to watch, as well as Bartolo Colon. They switched with Bartolo Colon and Noah Syndergaard, so it set up the pitching for the Washington series coming a little bit later in the month. And Bartolo Colon left the game after one batter with a bruised thumb. He caught a line drive back up the box, back up the middle, in with his right hand. It caught his right thumb. And boy, was that a little frightening after only one batter. And we thought for sure we'd lose Bartolo, but it turns out that he seems to be okay, so we'll find out more about that. But bullpen had to do the job, and they did. Hansel Robles, Eric Adell, Jerry Blevins, Addison Reed, and Jerry's Familia combined to throw 2.8 2/3 innings of one-run ball after Colon left the game in a 2-1 win over the Kansas City Royals on Tuesday. Collins brought in Robles, who threw a career-high 65 pitches in 3 2/3 innings. Robles pitched into the fifth inning and struck out 6 batters. "We were short tonight," Terry Collins said after the game, "so I just said he's got to be the guy. Let's see if he can get us to the fifth inning." Robles allowed 1 run and earned the Mets Player of the Game championship belt for a terrific performance. And as I said, he threw a career-high pitch of 65 and really did a fantastic job, as did the other guys in the bullpen as well. And on Wednesday, New York Mets utility man Matt Reynolds hit his first career home run and made his first start in left field in that win, a 4-3 win over the Royals. "That was probably one of the biggest moments I've had in my career," Reynolds said after the game. "It was a great feeling to help the team win." Noah Syndergaard left his start on Wednesday after 6 innings due to elbow discomfort, but does not have structural damage. He was cleared to resume his normal routine. Yoenis Cespedes left the game prior to the 6th inning due to left wrist discomfort and has been diagnosed with a mild wrist sprain. He has gotten a cortisone injection, will probably miss tonight's game in Atlanta. may even miss tomorrow night's game, but there's a possibility he could play tomorrow evening. We'll have to wait on that one. And the Mets activated Logan Verrett and demoted Ty Kelly to AAA Las Vegas prior to Wednesday's game to add an extra arm to the bullpen. Lucas Duda, who is dealing with a back injury, is still not doing baseball activity, so he hasn't been cleared, still riding a bicycle to try to stay in somewhat shape. Zach Wheeler, who is also dealing with elbow discomfort, saw a doctor, does not have structural damage, and has been cleared to resume his rehab as tolerated. And the Mets plan to have Bartolo Colon make his next start. So I guess he's feeling okay. He was supposed to throw a session today or this evening. We'll see how that goes. Steven Matz had some elbow tightness. He is downplaying it. He's saying he fully expects to make his next scheduled start. It could be that a lot of these young guys could be overcautious, and the team could be overcautious with them. And that's why when they feel a little twinge, discomfort of some sort, they're going to see a doctor. Rather have them do that and get it all, you know, checked out than to try to pitch through it and not pitch up to their full potential. So, but he says he's fine. Travis d'Arnaud was activated from the disabled list, and Sean Gilmartin was recalled from AAA Las Vegas as Kevin Plawecki was sent to Las Vegas, and Jim Henderson was placed on the 15-day disabled list. So lots of moving around going on for the Mets these couple of days, and but look, they took two from the Kansas City Royals, so not all bad. And Las Vegas 51 shortstop Gavin Cecchini has been named the Pacific Coast League Player of the Week for June 13th to 19th. Cecchini hit .440 in seven games this past week, and his 1.357 OPS was second in the PCL, while his six extra base hits, 21 total bases, and 10 RBIs all tied for second. The 20-year-old collected 11 hits and 25 at-bats with two home runs and four walks. He reached base at a .517 clip and also had a .840 slugging percentage. In his first season at AAA, Cecchini is batting .328, including four home runs, 13 doubles, 29 RBI, and a .854 OPS. So Gavin Cecchini starting to show some of the promise of a first-round draft pick and having a pretty good year in Las Vegas. And more promotions, some minor league promotions, I should say. Mets shortstop prospect Ahmed Rosario has been promoted to Double-A Binghamton. Rosario, 20 years old, was hitting .309. With three home runs, 10 doubles, 8 triples, and 40 RBI in 66 games for High A St. Lucie. He is viewed as one of the best position players in the Mets system. Taking his place in the St. Lucie lineup and in the infield is Sally League All-Star Vinny Sienna, former Cyclone, as was Rosario, who was hitting .291 with a .435 OBP atop the Columbia Fireflies lineup. Also promoted to the Florida State League was fellow Fireflies All-Star P.J. Conlin, who is 8-1 with a 1.91 ERA, who dominated the Sally League, showing superior secondary stuff compared to what the league normally sees. So some promotion, some prospects moving up the ladder, maybe a little quicker than we thought. That's a good thing for the New York Mets. And hopefully we will see them in the next year or so, or two definitely, in Citi Field. All right, time to take a break. And we'll be back with our special guest of the evening right after this.
Hey, baseball fans and book fans as well. This is Frank Nappy, author of the Legend of Mickey Tussler series, inviting all of you to learn more about my protagonist, Mickey Tussler, an incredible pitching prodigy who has autism. Follow Mickey's journey as he captures the hearts of fans everywhere with his blazing fastball and indomitable spirit. Please visit Amazon or www.franknappy.com for more information.
Hi, this is the world-famous Mr. Brewtown of BrewtownSports.Podomatic.com. You know, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, Brewtown Sports. You can also listen to the show at Stitcher.com, TuneIn.com, and iTunes.com. And we've got the new one. It's called BrewtownRadio.Webley.com. But the one that I'm most proud of being on is BaseballPodcast.net. It is the home of great baseball talk shows. Check it out, my show and all kinds of other programs all about Major League Baseball. So check it out. That's BaseballPodcast.net, the home for great baseball talk shows.
The Phillies and Mets rivalry has never been better. Hi, my name is Rich Baxter, and I host Phillies Talk Podcast. I hope you'll join me as we talk all about the Phillies all season long. That's Phillies Talk Podcast at FightinPhillies.com. And now back to Gary Mack.
And welcome back. I'm your host, Gary Mack, once again. And I am joined this evening by the author of a terrific book called When Shea Was Home, the story of the 1975 Mets, Yankees, Giants, and Jets. And for you that don't remember or too young to remember that, all four professional teams in New York played in Shea Stadium in 1975. And the author, Brett Tappell, is with me tonight. Brett, welcome to the show.
Gary, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And Brett, congratulations that you were just on the New York Times list in their book review, a summer pick for a good book to read this summer.
Absolutely. I was hoping that they might pick something up, and they made a gave me a nice little review, and certainly excited about that. No more excited, though, than I am to be on with you tonight.
Well, thank you very much. Well, let's tell the listeners a little bit about the book, Brett. I got to be honest with you, I don't even remember that all the four teams played in that one season. I remember the Mets and the Yankees and, of course, the Jets. I guess the kicker was the Giants that I didn't remember that played that year. But how did all of this come about?
Sure, and you're exactly right. The Giants are the one that really threw everybody into a tizzy. You know, in 1974, it was known that the Yankees were going to be renovating Yankee Stadium so that they would be spending the 74 and 75 seasons at Shea. That was agreed upon, in the early 70s when the Yankees decided to renovate. The Giants had decided and announced, I believe in 1972, that they were going to move to New Jersey. And the mayor at the time was not pleased with them, and they kind of were ostracized after the 73 season. So they went to play at the Yale Bowl in Connecticut, which was a disastrous experience for them. I believe they won one home game in 2 years in Connecticut. So, you know, by 1975 or before the 1975 season, New York had a new mayor. New York City did. Abe Beam and him and Wellington Mara were friendly, and Abe Beam invited Wellington to come play, one season at Shea, because it became apparent that Giant Stadium was not going to be ready until the 1976 season. So, yeah, when the Giants joined the party, that really put it into complete chaos.
And just an amazing situation. You would hardly ever see that today with all the stadiums, being built across the country, that they would actually go to this extreme in one. But at that time, there really wasn't anywhere else to go.
No, there really wasn't. And, you mentioned today, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Oakland is the only place, only city where they even share a baseball and football stadium, and who knows how much longer that's going to be. Of course, the Giants and Jets share a facility, but that's two football teams. Four teams in one stadium, and crazy as it sounds today, it was crazy then also. But you're right, the Giants didn't really have a place to turn to. Their fans were demanding something closer to New York City than New Haven, Connecticut. So there really weren't too many options, as absurd as it sounded.
And how did you get the inspiration to write this book? What made you want to write a book about Shea Stadium and this particular season?
Sure. Well, I always wanted to write something about Shea Stadium. I think, Shea Stadium, for all its problems and the rough ending it had, and it certainly wasn't a great place to go see a ball game towards the end. You know, it's kind of been looked at now with nostalgia, and I'm happy about that. I'm glad it didn't go the way of the Dodo Bird, or people say I'm glad that's gone. I mean, people think of Shea Stadium now and they think of it longingly, even though when we were there those last few years, there was really not much to it, and certainly Citi Field is a superior ballpark. But I wanted to write something on Shea Stadium. I stumbled across this story. Full disclosure, I was 5 in 1975, so I don't remember all 4 teams playing at Shea. But it seemed like a story that I hadn't remembered hearing about, and I just started doing some initial research, and the kicker for me to write the book, or to at least attempt to write the book, was I ran into head groundskeeper or former head groundskeeper Pete Flynn, who of course is now in the Groundskeepers Hall of Fame. There is such a place. And Pete was the head groundskeeper for the Mets in all their years at Shea Stadium. And I ran into him a game at Citi Field long after he was retired, and I walked up to him and I said, "Mr. Flynn, my name is Brett Topel, and I'm thinking about writing a book on the 1975 season at Shea." And he kind of looked away from me, and his Irish brogue said, "Ah, that season be the death of me." And that's when I knew that I had to write this book.
Well, for people who don't know, Pete Flynn was there for God knows how many years as a groundskeeper, and then as the head groundskeeper. And in fact, the one Pete Flynn story was that he drove the Beatles in 1964, I think it was. He drove them from the dugout they came out, and drove them to the round the pitcher's mound where their stage was set up for that concert, one of the first big concerts at Shea Stadium. And also, he drove Paul McCartney, if I'm not mistaken, from his dressing room underneath Citi Field, where out to the stage. I believe during the final concert at the Billy Joel's concert at Shea. So a little bit there, Pete Flynn, a little connection there, and I'm getting off the point, but
no, but you're absolutely right. And it was Billy Joel's last play at Shea that he got to drive Paul McCartney out there, and he actually reminded Paul McCartney that he had driven him out in 1965 for the Beatles concert. So that was really a cool little full circle thing for Pete Flynn.
Yeah, it certainly was. Now, we all know books are a very difficult thing to write, and it involves a lot of research. And you had the added, I don't want to call it a dilemma, but you were actually over 4 sports, or 2 sports, but 4 different teams. How did you go about lining up all of these interviews and that sort of thing?
You're absolutely right, and I think what I wanted to do when I started the process was to at least be able to get a sense from each of the 4 teams, to have somebody represented from that time period who can give me a sense of what it was like, in 1975. I had written a book about the 1929, 30, 31 Philadelphia Athletics, which I really enjoyed researching and writing, but the problem was no one was alive to talk to. So in 1975, although it was 40 years ago, I was able to really speak to a lot of first-person sources. With the Mets, I got to talk to players like Jerry Kuzman and John Matlack, Ed Cranepool, Bud Harrelson. I spoke to Howie Rose, who was awesome, giving me a great amount of his time and his knowledge. And as you know, there's not too many people more knowledgeable about the Mets than that. For the Yankees, it was really 2 people and 2 very different people who were awesome. Marty Appel, who was the PR director for the Yankees in 1975, who has gone on to write some unbelievable books of his own, including Pinstripe Empire and the Munson biography. I spoke to him at length. And I also got the chance to talk to Bill Verdon, who was the Yankees manager for the first half of 1975 until he was fired and replaced by Billy Martin for Billy Martin's first go-around with the Yankees. The Jets, I got to talk to Joe Namath's first choice for receptions that year, Richard Castor, who was his tight end. I got to speak to him about Namath and the Jets, and And he really gave me a good sense of that time. And for the Giants, I was really, really fortunate to talk to co-owner John Mara, who was in college at the time in Boston College, but attended every single one of the Giant games at Shea Stadium. And he really was able to share some good memories and good stories about his dad. It certainly was a dark period in the Giants' history. He told me how that his father's likeness was hung in effigy from the upper deck at Shea Stadium. But, you know, he was able to really, really, he was so generous with his time. And that's really, you know, the way that I was able to do it. Certainly research with magazines and newspaper clippings, but the first person sources for this book were really second to none.
Now, the logistics alone that year in scheduling all of this must have been unbelievable. How were they capable of handling all of that?
Well, you know, that's the only person that I wasn't able to get, because, I mean, who knows who made the schedules in 1975 for the league. But what I was able to do is talk to, you know, some of those Mets that I mentioned, and to say, listen, was this an imposition? Did you guys feel like the stadium was more crowded? And to a man, none of them really, you know, seemed to have a problem with it. The Yankees used the Jets clubhouse during the baseball season, so the Mets were not displaced. And, you know, the teams were rarely even in New York City at the same time. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of occasions where the Mets would take BP in the morning and the Yankees might take BP in the afternoon if it was an off day, and maybe the Jets would come in at night for a workout. But it didn't seem to be a problem for any of the players, although certainly the Yankees did not like playing at Shea Stadium, but I think that was less about the fact that it was crowded and more about the fact that Shea Stadium was certainly not the same kind of a hitter's ballpark as Yankee Stadium. It single-handedly caused the Yankees to trade Bobby Mercer. Ron Blumberg didn't enjoy it, so it was not a good place to hit. So I think that's why the Yankees disliked it more than the others. But, you know, that didn't seem to be, although I'm sure it was a scheduling nightmare for the schedule makers, the players themselves didn't seem to be bothered.
Well, we know Bobby Mercer definitely hated that. As you said, it led to him getting traded to San Francisco, where he went and had a pretty decent career, finishing off his career. But just an amazing thing that they could even get the four teams in. And, of course, you and I spent a lot of time at Shea Stadium over the years. So one of the big things about Shea Stadium that everybody remembers is the low-flying planes and the noise from all the jets going overhead. How difficult, I mean, the Mets were more or less used to it, but and perhaps the Jets were too, but how did it affect, did anybody complain from the other teams about all of this noise?
You know, there were some references to the Yankees being bothered by it. You're right. I mean, they used to roar right over Shea Stadium. In fact, I was at Citi Field the other night, and I think for the first time, obviously I've been at Citi Field so many times over the last, you know, almost 10 years now. Or is it 8 years since it's been open, 7 years? But it's funny because the planes don't really go right over Citi Field the way they went right over Shea Stadium. They seem to kind of go around Citi Field, and I don't know if that's because of where Citi Field was built a little bit, you know, away from Shea Stadium, where they changed the patterns. But yeah, I mean, I think the Mets and the Jets were used to it. I don't know that football really was bothered by much of anything. You know, the Jets and the Giants were both so bad, I think the least of their problems were the planes flying overhead. But, you know, like I said, if anybody was complaining about anything, it was the Yankees. They didn't like being in what Ron Blumberg said, smelly Jets locker room. And, you know, the planes were just another part of their inconvenience. But, you know, they knew it was very close-ended. They knew they were there for 74 and 75, and in 76 they were going to have a brand-new Yankee Stadium, and as it turned out, they had an American League pennant to go along with it.
Right. And, of course, it was not exactly a banner year for any of the teams that played there. Shea had nothing to do with that. They just weren't good. The Yankees had some promise, and as you said, the next year they won the pennant. That must have made it tough, too, not playing in a strange field and not really contending for anything, especially for the Giants.
Yeah, the Giants were really, of the four teams, and they were all, you're exactly right. I mean, the Mets were 2 years removed from a National League pennant, but were playing like a team that had never seen the playoffs.
Right.
The Yankees were probably the closest on the cusp. That, you know, 75 was the first year they had Catfish Hunter, and they had traded for Bobby Bonds, you know, in the Mercer trade. And they certainly looked like a team that had been getting ready to get good. You know, they fired Bill Verdon, as I mentioned, and on Old Timers Day introduced Billy Martin. So they had potential. The Jets, you know, Namath was finishing out what was a long and injury-plagued career, although 75 he actually played the entire season. The Giants, as you mentioned, complete mess. Craig Morton was their quarterback. Certainly was not his fault. Bill Arnsberger was their coach. Probably wasn't his fault either, because as John Marrott told me, they didn't give him a lot to work with. But, you know, it was really, you know, John Marrott said several times, you know, it was the darkest period in the Giants' history, and he likes to remember it only because he wants to make sure they never repeat it.
Well, we started this with Pete Flynn, and again, those of us that went to Shea Stadium knew that you just read all the articles about how bad the turf was. It was not the greatest condition. How was it able to stand up to all of this traffic going through it? Because I would imagine they also had concerts in between there. And other things. So how did the field, speaking about Pete Flynn, and that it almost killed him, how did it hold up for him?
Yeah, you know, I think during the baseball season, they did a pretty good job of keeping it playable. You know, a couple things about Shea Stadium. In 1975, there was no underground sprinkler system at Shea Stadium, so the entire outfield expanse and the infield needed to be watered by fire hose. So they had to do that every day. Also in 1975, the majority of ball players in the outfield were chewing tobacco. So they were spitting tobacco all over the outfield, which was killing the grass, which certainly was not helping it. When it rained, it didn't drain well. Ask Elliot Maddox, who left his knee somewhere out in right field. In fact, when he came back as a member of the Mets years later, he joked with reporters that he was going out to right field to see if he could find his knee. So it was a marshy wasteland when it was wet. When it was dry, it was as dry as can be. And I think, like I said, during baseball season, Pete Flynn and his crew did literally the best they could, and they did a great job. But, you know, by football season, it was a mess. You know, there was not only was the Mets, Yankees, Jets, and Giants games played there. They played the New York City High School Baseball Championships there. There was a charity football team with Eddie Robinson's Grambling team, which had Doug Williams as the quarterback, who ended up, of course, being the Super Bowl MVP with the Redskins. So there were really no days off. And one thing Pete Flynn told me, said, you know, by early to mid football season, there wasn't a blade of grass left in the place.
That's just amazing. It's just that they could have all of the four professional teams and then bring in other teams, you know, as you said, a charity football game and the high school championships. And just amazing. And but it was quite a year, and it's quite a book. So I urge everybody to go out and buy it now. They can have an opportunity to actually meet you and to sign the book at the main event in Farmingdale, and you're going to be out there sometime in August.
Yes, it's going to be Saturday, August 13th. That's what we said, right? Saturday,
yes.
August 13th at 11 a.m. So we'd love to have people come down, and we're going to have, I think, a little talk about the book. I think they do a Q&A, and certainly I'll be there to sign copies if people would like me to.
Well, that's going to be great. And, of course, the book is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and just all over the place. So go out and get a copy of it, right? Any other places that...
Yeah, no, I think you hit it, you know, online, Amazon and Barnes & Noble, you know, in New York and on Long Island. It's usually in the Barnes & Noble stores as well. And pretty much any place where you could buy books, hopefully you could buy When Shea Was Home.
Okay. Well, Brett, I want to thank you so much for taking the time this evening to come on and be on the show, and good luck with the book.
Gary, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
516-619-6341. That is the comment voicemail hotline if you'd like to be a part of the show. And drop us a line, leave us a comment or a voicemail question, anything at all. Call that number, 516-619-6341. Or go to MetsMusings.com and click on that widget in the middle of the screen, and that's a speak pipe, and you can leave a voicemail right through your computer through your computer's microphone. Or if you prefer to do things the old-fashioned way, send us an email at MetsMusings@gmail.com. The Facebook page is facebook.com/groups/MetsMusings, and the Twitter handle is at MetsMusings1. And if you'd like to help out the show, check out our Patreon page. Check out the campaign at patreon.com/MetsMusings. And tonight we're going to do a quick minor league report because we took a lot of time with our special guests. So Las Vegas is 39-33, and they beat Reno last night 12-10. Dilson Herrera with a grand slam home run to put the 51s on top in that game. And Binghamton lost to Altoona 6-3. Binghamton is 28-41 on the season. They are a struggling team, but they should it should help them now getting Ahmad Rosario and bring some more offense into that lineup. And Palm Beach defeated St. Lucie 3-1. St. Lucie is 35-32 on the season. And Columbia had their final night of the All-Star break, so they'll be back at it Thursday at home versus Augusta. And we have New York Penn League action now that the Cyclones are playing again. The season has started, and Connecticut beat them. Connecticut Tigers defeated the Cyclones 7-5 in Connecticut. Cyclones are 2-4 on the season, and it probably sounds like a broken record, but the Mets minor league team, all of them, have struggled with runnings in scoring position. Cyclones were the worst yesterday, going only 1-12, and it's almost kind of reminiscent of the parent club. Just problem scoring runs. And it seems to filter all the way down the minors. Let's hope that's something that can be corrected. Well, that does it for this edition of the podcast. This edition is brought to you by our Patreon supporters. If you would like to help in keeping this podcast going, I urge you to check out our Patreon campaign at patreon.com/MetsMusings. So thanks for listening to this episode. And until next time, keep the faith. Stay optimistic, and let's go Mets!